I'm going to begin today's sermon in the book of Deuteronomy, the first chapter. Start right there in the first chapter of Deuteronomy, and just a few verses that I want to cover at this point in time. It says in verse 2, "It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Now it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 7th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him as commandments to them." This is one of those passages of Scripture that it's easy to read right over. It's a very important passage of Scripture because it tells us when this was written or when they came here to where Moses began to record the book of Deuteronomy. He might have actually started it before that, but it's talking about the end of their journey, toward the end of the time that they had been in the wilderness. But what it says there is that it took 40 years to cover a distance of an 11-day journey. And so the obvious question is why? Why did it take so long to cover a journey that should have taken 11 days? Now, most of you who are here believe you can give the answer to that question. We understand, generally speaking, but the answer should be obvious, but is it obvious? Is it truly obvious to us? I was reading through a specific incident that we'll look at today, not too long ago, and it just struck me in a little different way than the way I'd read it before. And really it comes down to understanding what was going through the minds of these people. It's easy to look back and say, what a bunch of idiots they were. What a bunch of faithless people. But if we put ourselves in their shoes, we can begin to understand a little bit about our own human nature and what we might do under similar circumstances. So in today's sermon, we'll look at an incident a little deeper into this subject to learn not only what happened, but why it happened. We'll look into an incident that is recorded in the book of Numbers and draw upon five lessons that we can learn from this incident so that we don't make the same mistake. The incident that I'm talking about is found in the 13th and 14th chapters of the book of Numbers. You may have already guessed that. This is something that is often covered during the Days of Unleavened Bread or leading up to the Days of Unleavened Bread. This was when the spies, all except Joshua and Caleb, brought back a negative report following their 40-day exploration of the land of Canaan. And the upshot was that the people rebelled against Moses and Aaron. They murmured and they complained. They wanted to appoint another leader. They nearly stoned Joshua and Caleb, perhaps Moses and Aaron as well. But the end result was that an 11-day journey took them 40 years, and all those people died in the wilderness, all who were 20 years of age and up. They did not enter the promised land as they had set out from Egypt to do. And it's easy to condemn the Israelites in our own minds, thinking we would have reacted differently. I know the first time I ever heard this in a sermon way back in Pasadena, California, in the Pasadena Civic Auditorium where we met for Holy Days. We had 2,000-3,000 people in those Holy Days coming in from other parts of Southern California as well as the college and the main headquarters congregation. And I thought, how could they possibly do such a thing as that? After all, they'd seen the Red Sea open up. They had manna coming down during those years. They had so many miracles that took place that God used to bring them out of Egypt. And how in the world could they possibly react the way that they did? But unless we understand not only what happened, but why it happened, we're doomed to repeat their mistakes. And I think that over a period of time, many of us have come to the realization that we're not all that different from the children of Israel, that we make some of the same mistakes, that we grumble, we complain, we have our own difficulties. Now let me pivot for a moment to an example of what I mean by understanding why it happened, to give you something totally different, but it's relevant to this subject of understanding why. Many decades ago, I say many, more than three decades ago, I came into a congregation that had a particular problem, had a number of problems, but one of the problems was that a lot of the young ladies were finding themselves with children without a husband. And one particular one that I remember discussing, with more than one, but one that I'd like to mention here without naming the individual, found herself in that situation, and because there had been so many within a very short period of time, I had a very simple rule that whether you were the girl or whether you were the guy, in this case, most of them were girls that had gone to dance clubs downtown and other situations, and the fellows were not in the church, but sometimes they are. But it was a very simple rule. You're out of the church until the baby is born, and then we'll discuss coming back. And it didn't matter whether it was the girl or the boy that was involved. There had to be a change in direction. There had to be an understanding that this was unacceptable, that you can't just walk in and be a hero and have everybody give you presents and look at, you know, everything, showers and all that sort of thing, that this was a cultural problem that existed there and it had to change. And in discussing the situation with this young lady, she was quite emotional at times. And she said, well, you act as though I planned for this to happen. And as I explained to her, no, I'm not saying you planned for it to happen. What I'm saying is you did not plan for it not to happen. You didn't plan for it not to happen. And unless you understand what happened and why it happened, not so much what, but why it happened, you are doomed to make this mistake again. And at one point, she got quite emotional, and she said, you don't know me. This will never happen again. Well, she never understood why it happened. She couldn't comprehend the events that led up to it. Now, I'll come back to this a little bit later, but let me review the account in Numbers, and let's see not only what happened, but we'll also see why it happened. In Numbers, the 13th chapter, beginning in verse 1, says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each of the tribes of their fathers, you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. So Moses sent them out, and it lists all the names of the individuals. And it's interesting because these were real human beings. And perhaps we might say that maybe you would be one of the leaders. Put yourselves in the shoes of these individuals. You might be one of those leaders that was sent out. What an honor that would be to be just one of 12 individuals that were sent out to spy out the land. And I'm sure that they felt very privileged to be able to do so and were looking forward to that. But it didn't turn out exactly as they had planned it. So Moses sent them out. They went out, verse 21, they spied out the land, and it tells where they went and what they did. And verse 23, they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they carried it between two of them on a pole. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. Now we have this picture of this pole, two people carrying it, and this huge cluster of grapes. Well, you know, if you're carrying pomegranates, you can carry them in a bag or a knapsack of some sort. Grapes, it's a little different. You can't just put them in your pocket. I'm sure that this was a large cluster of grapes. That's the point of it. It reminds me of being down in Chile. We went to the home of the Brazos there near one of the suburbs of Santiago and went over to their house for dinner. And they walked us through the house and came to a patio in the back. And they had a grapevine that was 40 years old, and the trunk of it was about that big. It was a very large trunk on this grapevine. and it came up and it spread out over the whole patio. They had some wires or some bars to hold it up there. And here are all these grape clusters hanging down. And Mrs. Brazo went over and she cut a couple of them off and took them in, washed them up and brought them in, and we had fresh grapes right off the vine. But with grapes, you can't just carry them in your pocket. So they had a pole, and the sense is that this was a very large cluster of grapes. How large, we don't know. But the word Eshcol comes from the word cluster. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there, verse 24. So they returned from spying out the land, verse 26. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron, and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, "We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey." That's what God said that he was taking them to. "And this is the fruit. Nevertheless," so we have the good news and the bad news. The good news is a land flowing with milk and honey. The bad news is that the people who dwell in the land are strong. "The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." Now, when you think about it, just consider what it would be like to go into a land. You're going to take over that land. They had come to the iniquity of the Amorites, as God predicted. There was so much sin, and you can read there in Numbers, Leviticus, the 18th, 19th, 20th chapters, all the sins that they were committing in the land. And you realize that these people had gone so far in regard to violating God's law that it was time for God to take them out of their misery, you might say. And God didn't just wipe out a righteous people. But the children of Israel were to go in there. But there were fortified cities with high walls. We think of Jericho as an example later on that they took over. But when you think about assaulting cities, and you have to fight against cities with high walls, and these are very strong people, very large people in comparison to the Israelites, at least many of them, this was something that would be very frightening. We can sit back and say, "Huh, they should have just known." But they didn't. And how often do we, when we're in situations where we don't understand something or we're going against a difficult trial, how often do we panic and not follow through with what we know is the right course of action? So they're strong and fortified. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and Mr. Hernandez has talked a bit about Amalekites and the kind of people they were and how they attacked the weak people, and we look at Gaza today and believe that many of those are Amalekites and the atrocities that they committed. A couple men and their wives who were in Nashville for the NRB who saw a documentary on what happened in Israel on October the 7th, much of it from the body cams of the Hamas terrorists, and how they were gleeful as they slaughtered people. I won't go into details, but if you want to ask the Desmonds or the Wakefields, I'm sure they can give you a little bit of an idea. I don't think it's appropriate for me to describe those things here with children and all. It was an awful thing. And that seems to be forgotten by our media. But nevertheless, these are the kinds of people that they would be going up against. It says, they dwell along the banks of the Jordan. And then verse 30, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, the men, 10 of them, "We're not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." Now these were the eyewitnesses, and they said, "Look, we can't do this. This is too great a task for us. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." Now, it's easy, again, to say, well, we would have faith, we would just do it, whatever God says, but that's not our nature. And here all these people, 10 of the 12, saying, "No, this is a bad idea. This is not going to work out well." So all the congregation lift up their voices, verse 1 of chapter 14, and they cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Why has the Eternal brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims?" It's not just, I'm not afraid for myself, I'm afraid for my wife and my children. It's always easy to deflect that way. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? Wouldn't that be a better course of action at this point? So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." They actually wanted to vote in a different leader. Let's have a democratic approach here. That would fit very well in our world. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Eternal, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread." We'll eat them like our lunch. They'll be our lunch, which flows with milk and honey. Only do not protest, or only do not rebel against the Eternal, nor fear the people of the land, for they will be our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Eternal is with us. Do not fear them. Now, that's easy to say if you really believe that, and it's easy to hear, but when you have 10 people saying, "No, this is not a good idea," then which is the one that you're going to believe? Are you going to trust in God, or are you going to trust in your sight and what is being told you and the majority view? And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the congregation, or the children of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people reject me, and how long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them?" Now we'll get back to that in a little bit. But this is the stage. This is what happened here. And we know that they rebelled against God at that moment in time. So let's look and understand why this happened. Not just what happened, but why it happened. And I'd like to give you 5 lessons. Some of these overlap. I originally had 6 or 7 lessons, and we could probably have a dozen lessons that we could learn from this. But I'll just give them as 5 lessons. Lesson number 1, faith and sight are not the same. Faith and sight are not the same. Miracles most often follow faith. They do not create lasting faith. You might write down the lesson that way. Miracles do not create lasting faith. How often have we seen that even in this age? I have known a number of people over the years who have been healed miraculously. I'm not talking about had a cold and were anointed and 5 days later got better. I'm talking about things that are totally unexplained by medical science. Dr. Meredith often talks about Howard Clark, who was a quadriplegic and was healed. My wife and I knew Howard Clark. He's been in our home, stayed with us one time when we were in Monroe, Louisiana. He was my club director at Ambassador Club there in Pasadena for 1 year. He was an individual that was around the campus and everybody knew. He could play handball. Mr. Strain could vouch for this. Mr. Orban probably as well. He could play handball, but he also had two crutches that he would, after a hard handball game, he'd kind of walk around that way, just as, you know, helping himself a little bit. In other words, he was not 100% healed, but he was able to walk, whereas before he couldn't. And not only able to walk, but play a vigorous game of handball. And God had healed him. And most of the time, he'd just walk around as normal as anybody else. But again, there were times when he would be a little bit tired, and he would use these two walking crutches, you know, by hands. But clearly, God healed him. It was a miracle. And there were too many people in that area who knew that he was healed miraculously. There was a lady who had cancer that Dr. Meredith used to talk about. And I remember when it happened at the time. I didn't know the lady. She was up in, I think, Salt Lake City or someplace up in that area. And I never knew it. But I heard about it when it happened, that she had breast cancer and really got to the very last breath of life. And kind of breathed her last, as it were, and then sat up and said, "It's gone. It's gone." God healed her. And I've known of several others over the years, some that were very miraculous and I was, you know, very much aware of. But you know what? A lot of those people have fallen away for whatever reason. Those miracles did not keep them in the truth. Miracles do not last. We somehow come up with other explanations in our mind as to why something is the way it is, why something happened. Miracles do not last forever. They may last for a period of time. And is that not what we see with the children of Israel? If you walk through the Red Sea, seeing, you know, walls of water on both sides, not just a few feet of water, but like a wall of water above, well above your head, and you're walking through the Red Sea, that's something that's hard to forget. But that miracle did not last. And all the other miracles, the manna that came 6 days a week, it didn't last for him, did it? And so, while God had performed mighty miracles for them, they didn't stay. Over in 2 Corinthians 5, 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter. We could begin in verse 1, but I'll just read verse 7. This is a principle here, and it's quoted elsewhere. "For we walk by faith, not by sight." You see, we are to walk by faith, not by sight. The children of Israel were walking by sight. And if we're honest with ourselves, we often do the same. We often walk by sight rather than faith. And yet, as Paul told the Corinthians, we are to walk by faith. We walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, well-pleased, rather, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. It's talking about the resurrection here. And we trust in the resurrection. Of course, it's easy for us to do that because we're going to die anyway. And so let's hope for the resurrection. It's not something that we have to make a decision on right now, although we are making a decision right now in the way that we live. That's true. But it's not something where we come up to a wall and say, "Okay, I'm going to cross into this land." But we walk by faith, not by sight. In Hebrews, the 3rd chapter, it tells us that the children of Israel really did not trust God. That was the problem. I'll begin here in verse 15. He says, "Well, it is said, today, if you will hear his voice. This is Hebrews 3:15. Do not harden your hearts in the rebellion. For who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt, led by Moses? Now, with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? Yes, we know that they sinned. We know they rebelled. But notice as we read the rest of the chapter here, what the real problem was. He says, and to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. They didn't obey because they did not believe. Now, there's a difference between believing and faith. Lucifer believes that God exists, but he doesn't have faith that what God says is right. But they're very closely associated. They did not believe God. They did not have faith in God. And so in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, we see here the faith chapter, and it begins with something that sometimes people misunderstand. It says, now faith, verse 1, Hebrews 11, verse 1, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I've heard a number of times over the years, usually some of our younger ministers will say that, well, this shows us that we have substance for our faith, or in other words, we have evidence of faith. We don't have blind faith. And that's true. We don't believe blindly. We have reason to believe that God exists. We have reason to believe that the Bible is his word. But there are people that believe that God exists. There are people that believe that the Bible is the word of God, but they don't believe that they have to obey it. You have many billions of Christians who subscribe to the Bible, but they reason around the Sabbath day. They reason around other things. They don't fear God in that way, and they don't tremble before the word of God. But faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. In other words, evidence is important, but faith is the evidence to act on what is before us. That is evidence. Faith is evidence. It's not that we have evidence for our faith. That's not the point of this verse. It is true elsewhere that we see that we don't have blind faith, but that's not the point of this verse. And I wrote an article on the subject some time ago, a couple years back. But faith is the evidence of things not seen. You see, when the children of Israel came to the promised land and they spied it out, they had plenty of evidence that God exists, the opening of the Red Sea, the manna every day, all those miracles that took place in Egypt, the death of the firstborn and their protection. They had plenty of evidence, but you see, they didn't have the faith that comes from God. And so we need the faith of Jesus Christ in us. That's why Dr. Merrith looked at Galatians 2:20 as, I think, his favorite verse. I think we could easily say that. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence. Well, I'm quoting here now instead of Galatians 2:20, but you can read that. And it talks about we are crucified with Christ, yet nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. We have the faith of Christ in us. That's what we need to have, is Christ's faith in us, because the children of Israel, their faith was up and down. And when they saw something that they couldn't understand, or they couldn't understand how they could overcome the obstacle, they panicked and they went a different direction. So, lesson number one, faith is not lasting. Faith and sight are not the same. Miracles often follow faith, but they do not create lasting faith. Miracles do not create lasting faith. So when an individual says that, well, if I could just have this miracle, if I could just see such and such, then I would believe, that's a myth. It doesn't work that way. Lesson number two, We must have faith to overcome our human emotions of fear, you know, that which we don't understand. Faith must create courage. We must have faith to overcome our human emotions of fear and of things we may not understand. Over in the book of Revelation, the 21st chapter, we're familiar with this. Verse 8, Revelation 21, verse 8. He's talking about we must overcome in verse 7. He says, but the cowardly, those who do not overcome their fears, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, describes all these terrible things, and he says, all liars shall have their part in the lake of which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. In other words, to be cowardly is to be thrown into the lake of fire. Now, that does not mean that we don't have fear, but faith must overcome that fear. When you look at the book of Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter, we see something that is interesting there, because God knew that fear, especially when it comes to groups, can be very damaging. And so in Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter, he describes going to battle, going to war. And in verse 3, he said, he shall say to them, this is the priest who should say to them, the people, hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint, do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. Then the officers, verse 5, shall speak to the people, saying, what man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. So even in the battles that Israel fought, there would be casualties on their side. Also, verse 6, what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. Verse 7, what man is there who is betrothed to a woman who has not married, her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. Then the officers in verse 8 shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. Now, I would imagine that most of the men that were going into battle had a certain level of fear, but he's talking about those who are just panicked and really, they were not ready for this. And he says, let them return home. In other words, a smaller fighting force was better off than a distracted force or a fearful force, because when one man panics, then somebody else does, or they're more likely to do so. It's an interesting statement there on human nature, but when they were to go into battle, they were going to have some losses. And he wanted people who would be courageous, people who would overcome the natural fear that they might have. And is that not what we see what happened with the people when the spies came back? We had some that were faint-hearted, 10 of the 12, and they caused panic amongst all of the others. We have the other examples of Daniel and his three friends, as I brought out in a sermon earlier. They no doubt had fear, but they overcame their fear. But Israel never learned that everything was a test for them. Everything that Israel did was a test. And so he had them go in against a people that were stronger than they were, because he would be with them. All the things that happened to Israel, going 3 days without water and having a lack of food, at least it seemed like at times. All the things that happened in the wilderness were tests. And God brought them to the promised land, to a land that had giants, as it were, a land that had fortified cities, to see what they would do. Notice over in Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter, Deuteronomy 8, and I'll begin in verse 1, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord your Lord swore to your fathers. Verse 2, Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, and you shall remember that the Lord your God, or the Eternal your God, led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness. Why? To humble you and to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. It was a test to see what they would do. Notice verse 16, breaking into a thought here. Who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Remember what was given in the sermonette back in Exodus 16th chapter, verse 4. He was going to rain down manna. He was going to test them whether they would obey his command or not. And the command was, gather it 6 days, but don't gather on the seventh day. That was a test for them. It was a test for them just to not gather up too much on one day and try to keep it over. God wanted them to follow his command precisely. And we find that there were those who did not. That he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Do we realize that that's what God is doing with us? Sometimes we go through trials and we don't understand them. Sometimes we have a loved one die. Sometimes we get sick and have terminal illnesses. Sometimes we suffer. There are a lot of things that happen to us. But do we realize that all of it really is a test? Because God is looking at a billion years squared. He's looking at a time span so far beyond this physical existence. But we're physical, aren't we? We're physical. That's all we know. And it's easy to try to protect the self right now instead of looking at the big picture. You see, Israel couldn't see the big picture. They couldn't see down the road of living in that land. God, perhaps at that point, would have protected them at the beginning of the 40 years so that they didn't have losses. He would fight their battles for them. They wouldn't have to fight their battles in the same way. But they didn't trust God. So by the time you get to the end of Deuteronomy, well, things are a little bit different. But the bottom line is they just could not trust God. They were walking by sight. And yet we must overcome our fears. And we must have the faith to overcome our fears, to recognize that God will work things out. God is testing us. He's humbling us. And everything in life is a test, as Mr. Carl McNair used to say, it's all a test. And if we don't pass it this time, he's going to bring it on us again to test us again later on. Lesson number 3, we're easily influenced by the crowd that we can see rather than by God whom we cannot see. Or just very simply, we're easily influenced by the crowd. The RCMA, Religious Conference and Management Association conference, was in Kansas City one year. We attended it down in Fort Worth and Kansas City, and I seemed like someplace else, I don't remember where, but it was in Kansas City, and so we attended it there. And Alan Funt's daughter was there. He was the creator of Candid Camera. Now, some of our younger people probably don't know what Candid Camera is, but it basically they would have these setups and they would do some goofy things just to see how people reacted. And we have spinoffs from that as well today. But she showed us a couple of her favorite ones. One was on the elevator. And they had actors that were already on the elevator, and then it would stop at a floor and somebody would get on. And the actors would all turn to the back of the elevator. Now, there was no door at the back, but they would turn to the back. And it was always interesting how the person who was not in on the gag would turn with them. Everybody else would look in the back, and so he would turn to the back. And an even funnier one was where back in the 50s and the 60s, mostly the 50s, men wore hats, not ball caps, but actual dress hats with their suits. And you've probably seen some with Mr. Armstrong and even Dr. Meredith wearing a hat back in the 50s and earlier, 40s, 50s, and earlier. And so they would be on the elevator, someone would get on with a hat, and they would take theirs off. And that person would take his off. And then they would put theirs back on. And the person would put his back on. It's really quite funny how easily someone could be led in that way. And that's just human nature. I took a class in sociology at Ventura College. And about the only thing that I remember from the class was that people react different in groups, differently in groups than they do as individuals. And that's what this is all about. We don't always act the same when we are influenced by other people than we would if we're all by ourselves. In Proverbs, the first chapter, it gives us some advice. Proverbs 1, beginning in verse 10. He says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood, let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down to the pit, we shall find all kinds of precious possessions, we shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us, let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them, keep your foot from their paths.'" And it goes on, but the point is, he's saying, don't let the crowd cause you to do something you know you shouldn't. What do we call that today? Peer pressure. Peer pressure. And young people are especially susceptible to peer pressure. When you're by yourself, you might not do something, but when all the guys you're with, or the girls, but specifically the guys usually, they want to do something, who wants to be the one that says, "Hey guys, I'm not a part of this"? Sometimes our young people will take the right action. But too often, they'll follow the crowd, won't they? If everybody's smoking, if everybody's using drugs, if everybody's drinking, they'll follow the crowd. They'll do it. And you know, adults are also subject to peer pressure. Go along with certain things. And I'll give you a couple of biblical examples of that in a minute here. In the book of Exodus, we are told not to follow a crowd. Exodus 23, this is in the Old Covenant there. But the principle is right. It's something that we should pay attention to. Exodus 23 and verse 2 says, "You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice." I remember one time on, I'll date myself, Bonanza, the program, Haas and Little Joe, yeah, thank you. I see somebody else has been around. The four brothers, Adam was there. Three brothers, four brothers, I can't remember all the details. But there was one episode where, I believe it was Haas, was on a jury. And everybody wanted to hang this guy or condemn him, whatever it was that they were going to do. I don't remember what the punishment was going to be. But he didn't believe that they were right, and he stood up against them. I wonder how many times on juries you have people who, well, you know, jury of 12, 10 believe one thing, 2 believe something else, will eventually give in. Sometimes you have a hung jury where somebody will stand his ground. But how many times do people give in to the majority in that way? You know, when I look back on my life, there are times that I wish I'd have stood up a little differently than I did. And I would imagine that many of us in this room have been in that situation. In John, the 12th chapter, John 12, we find that adults, it's not just children that are subject to peer pressure, but in John 12, we see that not only adults, but people of some stature in life are subject to peer pressure. John 12, verse 42 says, "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God." You know, it's interesting there that these are the rulers of the people. But they loved the praise of men, people that they could see, as opposed to God, who they could not see. So we're easily influenced by a crowd that we can see rather than God whom we cannot see. Let's go to Acts, the 5th chapter, and let's see someone standing up as opposed to following the crowd. This is in Acts, the 5th chapter, and I'll go straight to verse 29. This is where the apostles had been called into question for a miracle, and they were told, verse 28, "Did we not strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us." Verse 29, "But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, 'We ought to obey God rather than man or men.'" So here we have Peter and the apostles, they're standing up. Interesting, Peter and the other apostles. So there was a group of them. And perhaps being in a group, that gave them a little extra courage that, you know, we can stand together here. I don't know. But it just says that there were others that were with them. And they stood up against the authorities at that time. And this was a very dangerous situation. They overcame whatever fear they might have had. It doesn't indicate they had much fear. They just stood up and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." But let's go over to Galatians, the 2nd chapter now. Galatians, the 2nd chapter. And the Apostle Paul says this, beginning in verse 11. "Now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision." So in one case, Peter stands up saying we ought to obey God rather than man. But now in a different circumstance, and I think this is instructive because there are times when, yes, we're strong and we'll stand up. But there are other times when we get caught off guard, perhaps. The circumstances are different. It's a different situation. And we don't stand up as we should. So here's Peter, who would eat with the Gentiles, but when he saw those people coming from James, in other words, from Jerusalem, the Jews that were coming from Jerusalem, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision, fearing them. Verse 13, "And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy." You see, it spread from one to another. Now, does that mean that Peter and Barnabas and the others that were there were totally evil people that we just say, okay, well, we'd never follow them. No, they were corrected by Paul. They recognized their error. They changed, obviously. You know, it was Peter that God used to bring the Gentiles into the church in the beginning. We see that sometimes our faith is not always static. It rises and falls. There are sometimes when we're not influenced by the crowd, but in other circumstances, maybe because of who it is or the different circumstances, we can be influenced by the crowd. So we must understand that that is part of our nature, that it's easy to be influenced by a crowd that we can see rather than God whom we cannot see. That's lesson number three. Lesson number four, there comes a time when it's too late, when the die is set. Let's go back to Numbers 14. And let's just notice that sometimes mistakes that we make are of the nature that there's no turning back. We might turn back, but God's not going to. Here we have Numbers, the 14th chapter, verse 39. It says, then Moses told these words to all the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. And they rose early in the morning and went up to the top of the mountain. Well, what were the words that they were told? Let me go back and pick that up. Verse 34, where this is a memorization scripture, according to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. In other words, God was going to cause them to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. That was stated. But when Moses tells them the words, the people mourn. They had buyer's remorse, you might say. They realized, maybe we did make a mistake here. Maybe we should have gone in. So, verse 40, they rose early in the morning and went up to the top of the mountain, saying, here we are, and we will go into the place which the Lord has promised, for we have sinned. We've made a mistake. We'll go in. They said, we're not going to. Now they say, we're going to go in. And Moses said, now why do you transgress the command of the Eternal? For this will not succeed. This is not going to work. It's too late. You're going to spend the next 40 years in the wilderness. You want to go in now? It's too late. You should have gone in when I told you to. But you murmured, you complained, and God had enough of it. He says, verse 42, do not go up, lest you be defeated by your enemies, for the Eternal is not among you. God's not with you. You're going to be on your own. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword because you have turned away from the Eternal. The Eternal will not be with you. But they presumed to go up to the mountaintop. Nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant or the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. Verse 45, then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who dwell in the mountain came down and attacked them and drove them back as far as Hormah. God was not with them. There comes a time when it's too late. There comes a time when to use another analogy, when the door of the ark is closed and the rains begin. Another example is 1 Samuel 15, another famous example here. 1 Samuel 15, and I'll begin in verse 23. This was when Saul was to go up, and he was to fight against the Amalekites, because God was going to have war with Amalek forever because of their nature and how they would attack the weak and the defenseless. And instead of destroying them all together, they saved the best of the sheep, and they saved the king of the Amalekites that was there. And then in verse 23, it says, for rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Now, when you think about it, here was Saul, who was chosen to be king. He really had the opportunity of having his dynasty be like David's dynasty forever. for the Messiah to come from his offspring. That's what Saul had the opportunity of, but he's been rejected because of this and some other things that happened before that. And so God later chose David. But right now, we see Saul said to Samuel, "I've sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Eternal and your words." Now, why did he do it? For the same reason the children of Israel didn't go into the Promised Land, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. He was influenced by the mob, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Eternal. But Samuel said to Saul, "I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Eternal, and the Eternal has rejected you from being king over Israel." And Samuel turned, and Saul seized the edge of his robe and tore it. In other words, he said, don't go. Let's think this over. There comes a time when it's too late to change. It doesn't mean it's for us in the sense that it's too late to be in God's kingdom, but there comes a time when whatever the penalty is going to happen, and we're not going to change it. It's like the child who disobeys his father, and father says, "Well, when we get home, you're going to get a spanking," and the child, "Oh, I'm sorry," you know, and you still have to follow through. You can't just let, at the last minute, something to be changed. There comes a time when the die has been cast. Lesson number 5, we must all answer for ourselves before God. We must all answer for ourselves before God. Joshua 24. We find the nature of Joshua. I say that the nature, the character of Joshua here in this one verse. Joshua 24 and verse 15. Joshua lays it out before the people, lays out the options. And in verse 15, he says, "And if it seems evil to you to serve the Eternal," if that seems like a bad idea, "choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." You can go back to Egypt, you can go back to go and serve the gods of the Amorites. But he says, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal." You know, he was of different nature than the rest of the people, and that's one reason that he went into the Promised Land, he and Caleb. Over in Romans, the 14th chapter, Romans 14, in verse 10, he says here, "But why do you judge your brother, or why do you show contempt for your brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ." We're all going to stand before God's judgment seat, or the judgment seat of Christ. And we'll all stand there, as it were, individually. I mean, there may be others there, but we will have to stand before the judgment seat of Christ as individuals. We're not going to get in on somebody else's coattails. We can harpoon ourselves from being there because of following others, but we're not going to be able to rely on others getting us in there. So knowing these things, understanding these lessons that we've covered here, that past miracles do not produce faith for today, that we must have faith to overcome the emotions of fear and frustration, that we must follow God whom we cannot see rather than men whom we can, that there comes a time when it's too late, and that we must all give account before God. Knowing these lessons, how can we plan to not make the same mistakes? Going back to the young woman that I was talking about before, I asked her, you know, how this happened. And she said, "Well, you act like I planned it." And I said, "No, as I said before, you just didn't plan for it not to happen." And I said, let's go back and let's walk through this. Where were you when this happened? Well, I was over at his house. Was anybody else there? No. Do you see any relationship between where you were and what happened? And she shook her head, no, she didn't see any relationship. And so I said, well, would this have happened had you been sipping on iced tea in the corner booth of Shoney's restaurant? And she kind of looked at me like, are you kidding? I said, you don't see any relationship between where you were and what happened? She didn't. But she protested with great emotion that I did not know her and that she would never do this again. I had to take more than one call from her when this child was born. And one time she said, I feel like I'm in a hole and I can't get out. She can't go to school. Her parents both work. She couldn't go to school. She couldn't get a job. She just had to take care of this child that wasn't exactly what she planned on in life. But you know, she never learned the lesson. She never was able to connect the dots between where she was and what happened and a number of other things that she should have been thinking about. She never planned for this not to happen, so she went on to have two more children out of wedlock, not all by the same person. She did not know her human nature. And so the question is, do we understand our nature? Do we understand that we are influenced by the crowd? We might say, oh, crowd never influences me. Well, maybe it doesn't, but maybe it does. Do we panic when we have fear? Do we panic, or do we overcome that fear with faith? Do we look to past miracles to give us that faith? Or do we recognize that this is a gift of God and we must go to God and strive to have that faith by crying out to God and fasting for God to give us the faith of Jesus Christ? The greatest predictor of future behavior is current behavior. Therefore, we must use every opportunity today to exercise faith, to overcome fear, to overcome our frustrations, and getting caught up in the emotions of the moment. And we must learn to trust God at all times, even when we don't understand. Recently, we were at the airport in Miami. Now, if you've never gone through international part of the Miami airport, you ought to do so just for the exercise of it. Sometimes it's total chaos, other times it's just slow frustration. But all these planes come in at 6 in the morning, everybody's been up all night, so you're tired. And you walk into the area where you have to go through immigration, or whatever they call it. Show your passport, tell them where you've been, and all this sort of thing. And so you can go through the fast lanes if you have certain privileges. But anyway, most of the people are going through. And there's this long line, and there are two agents working there. That's all, just two. And it's just going slow. Going slow. And then the other, the fast track people, because they've got global entry or whatever it is, they're kind of going through. And so you've got one or two people standing over there, agents, doing nothing. Well, thankfully, we had a fellow that had a little bit of ingenuity, or at least a little bit of foresight. And everybody else just kind of, nobody's in a hurry. But he decided, okay, well, I'll take groups of people to speed this process up. You know, in a situation like that, it's easy to sit back and just complain. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't make the line go faster. But it's our nature, isn't it? What's the matter with these people? they know these flights are coming in. Shouldn't they gear up for it? Well, then after that, you've got to go and find your luggage. And then you get into another line. And this is the one where they x-ray everything, including your check-on luggage. And they go through this process there. And then you have to find your flight. Well, we've always been able to get through there fine, but there were some people there that had a 6:30 flight and at 6 in the morning, and they're standing in this long line. There's no way that they're going to make that flight because the doors closed 15 minutes beforehand. So they got 15 minutes to do something that is just impossible. Well, people get frustrated at a time like that, and understandably so. But do we realize that everything in life, even though it's not our fault, is a test on how we're going to react? Because in a case like that, if we're upset and we're angry, what is it down the road that's going to cause us to complain and to murmur? We look back on the Israelites. They had a problem. They were having to go up against an enemy that was bigger and stronger than they were. We get frustrated because we have to stand in line a little bit longer. You know, how we handle little incidents today, little irritations today, how we handle decisions sometimes that are made by the church, whether they be right or wrong. You know, 4 years ago, we had to make decisions about masks and about meetings and all kinds of things like that. And we didn't have perfect understanding of things, and we made decisions. And I can look back and say, you know, some of those things we overreacted to. But we had to make decisions. And there are people that get frustrated by that, or they think they know more, and they go off not doing a work, just doing their own thing, feeding themselves. And we're all back to the same thing. I don't know of anybody wearing a mask here. Probably somebody might be. And that's okay. We're meeting together and have been for 3.5 years or a bit more. It was a very short period of time, just a couple months, till we started figuring things out. But if we are thrown by that, what is going to happen in the future? I was talking to a young fellow who was very concerned about a place of safety, and this group and that group and all these other groups and are going to be there in a place of safety because they're such wonderful people and all that sort of thing. You know, there are going to be a lot of decisions that are made in a place like that. Do we think God is not going to test us? There are going to be tests that come down the road that we can't even imagine. There's a lot that God is going to test us on because God wants to know what we will do. As with the young woman, we must understand why some things happen. We must understand our nature to follow the crowd, our nature to panic with fear instead of overcoming it. You know, 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, 1 Corinthians 10, really sums up a lot of this. He describes the children of Israel and how they were baptized on Moses in the cloud and the sea and all of that in the first few verses. And then it says in verse 6, "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, nor be idolaters, etc., etc., nor commit sexual immorality," verse 8, "nor tempt Christ," verse 9, "as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents." Verse 10, "nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." Verse 11, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come." And then he gives this warning, "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall."